The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Myron Rosenblum was the founder and first president of the American Viola Society, and then in 1977 co-founded the Viola d'Amore Society of America, and he is an expert on the instrument, the Viola d'Amore. He is even the author of the New Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians article about the instrument. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So I guess we should probably start with the very basic. What is a Viola d'Amore?
Well, it's a hybrid instrument that is shaped like a viol. It has sloping shoulders, high ribs, a flat back, a rosette, but does not have frets. And it is played like a violin or viola, not like a gamba. And its distinctive quality is that there are usually 14 strings, 7 playing strings, and then 7 additional resonating or sympathetic strings, as they're called.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would someone who was not familiar with the instruments, how would they tell by just looking at the instrument that this was, in fact, a viola d'amore and not a violin? Other than, you know, if they weren't counting strings, how would you know just by quick glance, or could you tell?
Well, I think they would see the peg box, the very long peg box, and that is a distinctive. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the short, you know, the short peg box of the violin or viola, which has only 4 pegs.
Okay.
So this is very long, and it also has a carved head at the top, which is rather unusual.
Mm-hmm. I know that there is some speculation that may be part of where the name comes from, Viola d'Amore. Could you talk a little bit about what the name means?
Well, there are lots of instruments that have amore attached to it. So, and it's very, very difficult to pinpoint that. Why? There are some theories. One theory is that because of its singular sweetness, that it's an instrument that, you know, conjures up a feeling of emotion, of strong emotion. There's another theory, which I don't subscribe to, that it was at one time called Viola of the Moors, because it does come from that, we think, from that part of the world. The Middle East, Arabic countries.
Mm-hmm. And some of the instruments have cupids on the head,
the typical carved head is a blindfolded cupid, you know, with the obvious connotation. But there are all kinds of heads. This instrument I have with me now has a lion's head. My other instrument has a prince, so just a carved head of a man. And then they're just ordinary scrolls as well on some instruments.
Mm. Now, your instrument, the instrument that you brought today, is it an actual antique instrument or is it a reproduction? And are there commonly both being played today?
Well, there are makers who are making them today, and some of them are very good instruments. I have two instruments, both made in 1731. The instrument I have here is Johannes Eberle from Prague, and who was quite a good maker and made a lot of violas d'amore.
Hmm. And the other instrument?
The other instrument is Johann Michael Sterzer, made in Breslau, which is now Wrocław in Poland, I believe.
Hmm. So now, what was this instrument's heyday?
Well, it first appeared on the European continent at the end of the 17th century, it really, really is a Baroque instrument. I mean, it is a product of the Baroque. It was quite popular in the Baroque, and a lot of instrument makers made them. So it was there. It was around, and being used.
Who would have played an instrument like this? Anyone? Any musician?
Well, they were probably violinists mostly.
Mm-hmm.
The viola players were not considered that fine players at that time, so they probably wouldn't have picked it up. But the violinist would have, mm-hmm. and played it.
Is that where viola jokes come from?
Well, probably, yes. You know, although, this is passé, but no, I mean, you know, the viola player today, they are wonderful,
yeah.
Wonderful players.
So how in the world did you come to this instrument? I mean, it is a relatively unusual instrument. Did you just suddenly one day say, oh, I have to play the viola d'amore?
Well, no. Right after college, I was drafted into the U.S. Army when they had a draft. And after my basic training, I was sent over to Germany. There was a wonderful orchestra, the 7th Army Symphony Orchestra in Stuttgart. And I was sent over there to play viola in the orchestra. So for 18 months, I did that, which was quite wonderful since I was in the Army. And while I was over there, I started buying the archive recordings, the old archive LPs. And I saw that some had Viola de Mori music on it, played by Emil Zeiler, who I didn't know anything about. I thought they were wonderful. Vivaldi concerti, Ariosti sonatas, there was a Telemann triple concerto, all beautiful and wonderfully played. And so I just said, I have to find out what this instrument is.
So you had been a violinist.
Viola. Well, I started on violin, and then in college I switched to viola.
Okay. Do you still play the other instruments?
Oh, I'm a violist primarily. I mean, my freelance work in New York, whatever I do now, is on viola.
Okay. Yeah. So how is it different to play these instruments?
Well, the viola, or the violin viola, you have four strings tuned in fifths. And you have a fingering sequence which is very consistent, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4. This instrument here, I will have to get it to illustrate, is not tuned in fifths, but it's tuned in thirds, fourths, and fifths. Oh. So if you go from the bottom string up to the top to play a scale, you do not have the consistent 1-2-3-4 fingering. It changes for every string.
Mm. So it must be really hard to go back and forth between the instruments if you're, you wouldn't be necessarily playing them in the same gig.
Well, I do. When I do a St. John Passion Bach performance, I will play viola and viola de Mori. And at this point, I've played for enough years, I can do that. I can switch.
Yeah.
And my viola and this viola de Mori, they're about the same body length.
Okay.
So I can do it.
Well, that was my next question is, are there different ranges? Other instruments have alto and tenor and bass. Are there different ranges? I would think, of course, every instrument is a little different, of course.
Yeah.
But are there actual specified different ranges for this instrument?
To a small extent, yes. There is a violin d'amore, I don't think anybody plays that. But viola d'amore will come in smaller sizes. Mm-hmm. But there was also an instrument called the English violette. Which I will show you a picture of, which had 7 playing strings and 14 sympathetic strings.
Oh. Oh, wow. Wow.
So you would have, the same 7 playing strings, but the additional resonance.
Okay. Huh.
But there's no such thing as a bass viola d'amore, thing like that.
Okay. So you already mentioned the St. John Passion. Are there other composers or very familiar pieces that would really feature this instrument where you could really pick it out and it would make a very obvious difference in the sound?
Well, do you mean solo pieces or in the context, let's say, of opera or other?
Both.
Yes, there are actually quite a few pieces. Bach has 3 cantatas where he uses it. As a solo instrument. It really was a solo instrument in the Baroque period.
So which 3 cantatas?
36C, Schwenkt Empor, I think it is. 152, Tritt auf die Glaubensbahn. Wonderful piece. That's a chamber cantata. And then there's the secular cantata 205, Aeolus Appeased, I think would be a translation of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wonderful. And Bach used the viola d'amore in all of them.
And is it paired with a particular voice range, or is it just purely an instrumental solo?
No, it's usually used with a voice, often soprano.
Mm-hmm.
Bach and the St. John Passion uses it in tenor and bass. Mm-hmm. So used for all instruments, all voices, I mean.
So besides Bach, who else really, what other composers really tackled this instrument?
Well, Bieber, our wonderful, important composer for the violin, Heinrich Bieber, has a group of partitas in the last one called Harmonia Artificiosa. And the last one of that is a partita in C minor for 2 violas d'amore. It's a great piece. Vivaldi has 8 concerti, used it in Anisi Dominis, and one oratorio, Judita Triumphans, with a big solo in that. Telemann has a trio sonata with flute, a wonderful triple concerto that I mentioned with flute and oboe d'amore. And then he uses it in one, I think a passion, yeah. Hmm. Ariosto, I tell you, Ariosto, who was one of Handel's competitors on the opera, on the London opera stage, was a great virtuoso on it and wrote some wonderful sonatas for it. Kvanz has 2 trio sonatas. I'm going to have a list over here of some. Handel never wrote for it, but in the his opera Orlando, there are there's an aria for a male voice and 2 violette marine, which are, you know, hard to find out what that is, but it was probably violas with additional sympathetic strings. It's a wonderful aria. Christoph Graupner, the contemporary of Bach and Telemann, interesting composer, wrote about 42 works for the piece, his trio sonatas, mostly with flute, or Chalumeau. There are suites, overtures, concerti, and about 14 cantatas where he uses it. Locatelli, Reinhard Kaiser from the Hamburg Opera School, Johann Mattheson, important writer on music, Heineken, Johann Petz, Alessandro Scarlatti, and Schuchbauer, who I believe I mentioned to you before.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Schuchbauer.
Well, there really isn't much known about him, except he was a Benedictine monk that lived in the Munich area, first half of the 18th century. And there are 2 pieces by him that I think exist in Dresden in one of the libraries, one for 2 violas d'amore and 1 for viola d'amore with flute and basso. But one interesting character I might mention is the castrato Farinelli, who, you know, very successful. I guess he would be like a pop star today. I mean, he made a lot of money and women were all over him. At the end of his life, he retired to Bologna into a very wealthy estate. And Charles Burney, the writer, went to visit him. And this is what, in 1770, and Burney wrote the following. Signor Farinelli has long left off singing, but amuses himself still on the harpsichord and viola d'amore. Mm-hmm. So he played the instrument, liked to play it.
So, I guess the instrument of retired castrati.
Yes.
you've listed the sort of the, I don't know, the dream team of Baroque composers here. You know, they're not a big name left out. And yet it doesn't seem like it's a very common instrument or commonly known. Why are we not more familiar with the viola d'amore?
Well, I think there's a practical side to this, and that is that it's kind of an annoying instrument to play. I mean, it is challenging. I used to use gut strings a great deal, but they get easily out of tune, subject to weather change and so on. I think a lot of instrumentalists are just lazy. They just don't want to bother learning a different fingering system. Interesting that in the Baroque period, the player was supposed to tune in the key of the piece. And that meant, you know, a lot of different fingering systems. And there is one writer on instruments, let me get his name over here, Joseph Meyer. Wrote a book in 1732, Museum Musicum, mostly depicting instruments and describing them. And he gives 16 different tunings for the viola d'amore. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's wonderful when in the Vivaldi concerti, he uses D minor, D major, A major, A minor, F major. And for each tuning, the instrument just has such a wonderful change of color.
So who are some of the big players today? Who are some of the people who are really keeping this difficult instrument alive and into the future?
Well, I could mention some people today who I don't think anybody would know. In In my society, we have a number of players in some major orchestras in Europe. But people who passed away fairly recently, who were great players in my estimation, were Walter Trampler, great violist, who specialized in contemporary music but just fell in love with his instrument. Emil Zeiler, who did these wonderful recordings for Arkiv, was a great player. Paul Hindemith was a violist and also concertized on the Viola d'Amore for a while.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Henri Caisser de Sceaux of the Caisser de Sceaux family had an early music ensemble in which he played Viola d'Amore. And I'm trying to think who else there might be. Renzo Sabatini, who was one of the moving forces of one of the Italian early music groups when they first started coming here, the Virtuosi di Roma. He was a very fine player.
Hmm. Well, clearly there are enough people who are playing the instrument and interested in the instrument and the composers and music written for it to have a Viola d'Amore Society of America.
Yes.
So what kind of activities do you do and what, you know, who, how many people are involved with this and what's the movement about?
Well, we have about 120 players, international players. I'd say the majority are American players and German players, but we have some in Switzerland, Austria, Italy, France. And what we do, we have two newsletters every year, which we publish, dealing with the instrument history and practical issues about the instrument. And we publish music for it. But the main focal point are our congresses, which take place every other year. Mm-hmm. And our next one is coming up 2008 in a wonderful Benedictine monastery in Germany called Ochsenhausen. And not too far from Munich, and where we will gather and play and talk and have fun.
Hmm. So there's still music being written for this instrument.
Yes.
And is it Baroque, you know, neo-Baroque, or is it contemporary style?
Some of it is very avant-garde.
Really?
Very contemporary.
Who are some of the people writing today?
I'm trying to think. Richard Wernick, an American composer, wrote a piece for it. Hans Werner Henze has written something for it. Schnitke from Russia wrote a very nice piece for it.
Hmm.
There are some others around. But historically, though, we have Hindemith, who wrote a wonderful sonata and a chamber concerto, the Kammermusik No. 6. Frank Martin, the Swiss composer, wrote a sonata da chiesa for Viola d'Amore and organ. And then there are many other composers, probably unknown to most of us.
I want to back up just a little bit because before you said there aren't more people playing this because musicians might be a little bit lazy. It's a very difficult instrument to play, to master, to tune. What does one do? What is a conductor to do if you're putting together a performance of the St. John Passion, for example, or something that really calls for this very distinctive sounding instrument, and you don't necessarily have access to a Viola d'Amore player?
Well, the easy way out is to St. John Passion is to use two violins instead of the violas d'Amore. Or they could just, tell one of the, ask two of the players in the viola section to just borrow instruments and learn it. That doesn't always work.
Mm. Yeah. I would love to hear some of the particular sounds, specialties, gimmicks, for lack of a better word, that the instrument can do.
Let me just illustrate what the tuning is, because this is the standard tuning. By the second half of the 18th century, the time of Karl Stamitz, who was a virtuoso on the instrument, the tuning became set into the key of D major. And that is what it is today, usually. So this is from the bottom string up. This is A, which is two notes below the viola C, low C, D, A, So it's quite a wide range, encompassing both viola and violin, really.
Okay. Now, what is the how do I want to say this? What are some devices or some things that make the viola d'amore, the sound of the instrument, sort of particular and unique?
Well,
besides the tuning.
Yeah, outside of the timbre, which is I think has a special sound, we can play double stops fairly easily, and this is the beginning of, I know this is a Baroque program, but Hindemith, his Kleine Sonata. So we can play parallel fourths very easily and things like that. Mm-hmm. We have harmonics. Wow. Sound difficult, but they're really not because they are there. These are the natural harmonics. Mm-hmm. And chordal playing is also possible. So let me just illustrate a part of a wonderful piece by Karl Stamitz, classical composer. And he wrote a wonderful duo for viola d'amore and viola or violin. And one of the movements is a la chasse, hunting, which he tries to imitate hunting, French horns used in hunting, by the use of double stops. Okay.
Is beautiful.
The instrument was very sought after for the effect, very important concept in the Baroque period. And there was a wonderful book published on instruments by Johannes Weigel, published sometime between 1715 and 1725. Mm-hmm. I would just like to read what he writes about the viola d'amore, because I think it's very typical of the way the mentality of the 18th century person and musician about the instrument. Weigel says, "I am called viola d'amore rightfully because my extraordinary resonance places lovers in a mood of pleasure and joy. Yet I am often praised by troubled people, since in their great pain, my sweet tone delights them. Whoever understands and loves music will freely admit that I should be called gracefulness itself by everyone." Oh. It's almost romantic. Hmm. And some of the other writers who came a little later. Leopold Mozart wrote in his violin Schule, 1756, the year that his son was born. He says, "It is a special kind of violin which sounds particularly lovely in the stillness of the evening." Hmm. Johann Albrechtsberger, the teacher of Beethoven, in 1790 wrote, he speaks of it as a pleasant chamber instrument. Johann Mattheson, somewhat earlier, in one of his many books on music, said about it, "The amorous viola d'amore is worthy of the name truly and expresses great languishing and tenderness. Its sound is argentine or silvery, at the same time extremely pleasant and lovely. It is a pity that its use should not be greater." And Mattheson used it himself in his opera, Boris Godunov, where he uses it as a solo instrument.
I have to agree. It is a pity it is not used.
Yeah. Well, if I can just jump to Hector Berlioz, we're not in the Baroque, but Berlioz never wrote for the instrument, but in his treatise on instrumentation in 1844. This is what he says. It is particularly suitable to the legato style, to dreamy melodies, to the expression of ecstatic or religious sentiments. How beautiful would be the effect of a mass of violas d'amore in an andante, executing a beautiful prayer in several voices, or accompanying in sustained harmonies a melody of the viola, the violoncello, the English or French horn, or the flute in the middle range, combined perhaps with harp arpeggios. It would truly be a pity if this wonderful instrument were lost for practical use, especially since any violinist can learn to play it within a few weeks. Not quite true, but that's what he says.
It's really beautiful, and I think it's one of these, not really a lost art, but maybe an overlooked art.
Well, I think it's come back. I mean, with the interest in Baroque music and early music performance practices, more people are getting interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? And this is perhaps for another part of another interview. But why do you think people are interested in Baroque music or becoming interested with some of these instruments that are not as commonly known? What do you think is behind that?
Well, outside of the spirit of the Baroque, which I think is wonderfully special. I think people want new sounds. They're looking for fresh things to listen to. And since we are being bombarded by so many other kinds of music, which I sometimes find offensive, I think that these gentle sounds are just wonderful. The viola da gamba, wonderful instrument, outstanding. The Baroque flute. Interesting that many of the Baroque composers pair the viola d'amore with the flute in their trio sonatas.
Why is that?
I think they just blend wonderfully together.
A kind of sweetness. And again, I want to sort of rewind in my mind to something we talked about at the beginning and when we were talking about your specific instrument. What was the significance of some of the carved heads, scrolls? Is there significance to it? Were they marking maybe a maker, or was there some significance into how this instrument was supposed to play, or was it just purely a design element?
I think it was. I would say a design element, an aesthetically attractive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I mean, where the instrument came from is. We just don't know. And perhaps some of the, my feeling is it comes from the Middle East, Persia, Turkey, and that perhaps some of those instruments had carved heads. I'm not an expert on ethnomusicology, but.
Well, Myron Rosenblum, thank you very, very much for making time to speak with me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.